lasted longer than expected because the chair ended up being tied down on another committee where he thought he'd go in and go out, and I apologize for that. We previously recessed from our work session on House Bill 3084. We will go back into work session on House Bill 3084 and call up Representative Rob Patridge. Good morning, Representative Patridge, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We had some questions and concerns from committee members on 3084 and its amendments, and we thought it would be best if we had you come up to explain the intent of the bill and the amendments and perhaps answer a couple of questions, if you would, please.
Okay. Just very briefly for the reason for the bill, there are many jurisdictions in the state of Oregon currently that have what they call a deferred sentence, where they would come in and sign an affidavit, where a defendant would come in and sign an affidavit where they would plead guilty. The DA would then hold that deferred sentence, wait until they completed some terms of probation, restitution, or whatever the case may be, then the case would be dismissed. There's also what's called a diversion in the state of Oregon, which is formally allowed by statute. The problem is many judges, or not many, but there are judges in the state who won't agree to a deferred sentence because it is not within the statutes. That is the reason I brought this piece of legislation forward, is to allow for a conditional discharge. We have the exact same thing for a first offense drug crime currently under the statutes now. It would allow a judge to take a guilty plea, and then after the person completed their whatever terms of their probation or the terms of the agreement would be, then that case would be dismissed. One of the reasons that district attorney's offices choose to use a deferred sentence, conditional discharge kind of program is that a lot of times we'll have someone come into a diversion program and then take off and never complete the terms of their diversion. Well, when you have multiple misdemeanor cases over the course of time, it's very hard to track them. Officers leave, then you pick someone up 3 or 4 years later. It's an opportunity to give them a break and have an opportunity on a first offense. But it allows for the district attorney to make that decision, just as a district attorney makes a decision whether to fully dismiss a case or not. Also allows people to be responsible and get into treatment programs, do some reformation.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative. You said that currently judges are reluctant to use this opportunity because it does not specifically state in statute that they have the authority to do so.
That is correct. However, many jurisdictions allow this to happen on a deferred sentencing basis. However, there are some jurisdictions that the judges will not allow it.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. Representative, and so what is the process currently in the courts where judges may use this process? What is the current process? Does the district attorney have to agree before the judge would make that decision?
Could you clarify, make which decision?
To defer the sentencing. I mean, you said currently some judges do this now.
Correct.
And this bill would require the district attorney to concur, to make the motion to the judge to defer the sentence. And so my question is where it currently happens already without this statute, does the judge make the decision, or does the judge only make the decision if the district attorney requests him to do so?
My understanding is that the judge only makes the decision when the district attorney asks them to do that, as well as in the diversion program. There's a DUI diversion program, and there's other misdemeanor diversion programs. The DA also brings forward diversion programs typically as well, and the district attorney is the one typically who takes the lead on those.
Mr. Chair, I hear some confusion as to what's happening. Currently, a judge, after a verdict is entered, could in fact decide not to sentence the person if they decided, for whatever reason, to not go forward. So that's something that's within their inherent power to do. Is that correct? I mean, not that it happens much, but it, it can happen where they can...
Well, the judge could, I suppose, not sentence them to anything if they're found guilty, and
right.
So therefore there wouldn't be anything.
But what you're trying to do is put into statute a program that is currently informal, where the district attorney is actually in the driver's seat of allowing someone to go into a special program similar to diversion, but requiring a guilty plea or a finding of guilt prior to them actually going into the, whatever the DA diversion program or whatever that might be.
Correct.
And then if they fail to comply with the terms and conditions of this, the provisions that have been set forth in this agreement, then instead of starting at square one and needing to prove their guilt, that has already been received by the court but not entered as a judgment.
That's correct. Thank you for helping me articulate that, Representative Brzezinski.
And so at this point, it's basically where the one of the part of the language that people got hung up on is that it's the belief that the district attorney is going to be controlling in this process, when in reality they are, because they're the ones that bring the motion forward. But this does not prohibit a judge from doing what they currently can do, and this is no way would impinge on their freedom or inherent powers as a judge.
That is correct. The judge can currently do what they want, pretty much, in a lot of these cases. This is a way just to move forward from a district attorney's standpoint.
Representative Bowman?
Mr. Chair, if I may ask your vice chair a question. I guess the part that I'm hung up on is if the district attorney is going to move forward and request that the sentence be set aside, and the district attorney decides what the charge is and determines whether or not they go to trial, why do they take them to trial in the first place if they're going to ask the judge to set aside the sentence?
Vice Chair, care to answer? What's the point? Would he rather have Representative Patridge answer?
Well, Patridge, go first.
Well, district attorneys make the charging decisions about what they charge people with. And I think at times, and I think this committee has wrestled with this on occasion, is what they think is going to be the best for public safety purposes, what's going to be best for judicial economy, what's going to be best for these other things. This is just a way of formalizing that, rather than having a lot of messy paperwork filed that would allow the judge to vacate the case and do all these things. It's an intermediate step to allow someone to get into some kind of program if they've committed a serious enough offense, but they want to show some good faith towards their reformation. A district attorney now can make a decision if they want to charge someone with a violation, if it's a misdemeanor crime. So it's just another tool in the toolbox to allow individuals and district attorneys a choice in the charging and in the handling of cases. It also is a way to dispose of cases. Huh?
Excuse me, I interrupted you. I didn't mean to go.
No, go ahead.
Wouldn't it be fair to say that actually the passage of this bill would encourage district attorneys to use this practice, which ultimately for more people would mean that there'd be less entry of judgment of conviction because ultimately it would be set aside if they went through this the remedial program, I'll put it?
Well, I don't know if it would be more, but it would be a way to formalize it. I think it's being done predominantly around the state, but there are a lot of districts or there are a lot of judicial districts who won't engage in this kind of practice, and I think it's a better policy.
Well, I think you just answered my question. And if there are districts where they won't engage in this practice, by putting it into the statute, won't that mean that there's some districts that will engage in this practice and therefore they are giving someone, I'll call it an escape clause?
Certainly.
I'm just trying to help get that point across. Yes, Representative Hansen. And then
this reminds me of a story that I heard of on the Metro Council from one of the lawyers there who told of a country jury that was trying a young man that had a very bright future, but he'd made a significant mistake, and the jury came back with the decision that he was not guilty with the warning never to do it again.
Mm-hmm. All right, there's some difference.
Sure, I mean, it sounds to me from what Representative Patridge is trying to bring forward is some type of uniformity and clarity around the state. Currently, a district attorney can, in fact, enter into, on misdemeanor cases, diversion agreements, and actually require a person to enter a guilty plea. So there is a formal process now, but there's another means of accomplishing the same thing by having the person go through certain steps. And I think it's the important part here is that without entering the judgment on line 6, this is if the person on line 7 consents to the disposition. So there is going to be some sanctions put in place based on them agreeing that this is going to happen. And it's kind of, I guess, basically what Representative Hansen says, that there are all those cases where the court or, in this case, the district attorney makes a decision, and it could be at a point where instead of dismissing the case outright, based on the evidence or whatever comes in, they determine that justice would be best served by doing this and not having the mark be with the person for at least 3 years before an expungement can occur. That's about the best I can try to summarize it. But either way, I mean, if this goes down, DAs are still going to use another process to do the same thing. It just seems that Representative Patridge wants to try to make sure that the districts that are currently not doing it because they don't think it's provided for by statute has that authority.
Thank you, Representative Przanski. We are in work session. Representative Przanski, do you have any motions on these two amendments?
Mr. Chair, we've already, I think, made the motion on the dash 2.
That's right.
And I think that was accepted.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
So
it's the dash 1.
I would move the dash 1s into the bill.
The motion is to adopt the dash 1 amendments. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Przanski?
I move the bill as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? All right. Clerk will call the roll, please.
No.
Representative Gianella?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Clancieri?
No.
Vice Chair Korzanski?
Aye.
Chair Manning?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3084 is sent to the floor of the due pass by a whisper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, before Representative Patrick leaves the room, I request that he carry the bill on the floor.
I'd be happy to.
Representative Patrick will carry the bill. This closes the work session on House Bill 3084. And I believe, I see Mr. Gardner here from the Attorney General's office, so we will move forward to trying to keep my agenda straight here. We already handled 3110. We're going to move down to 3492. And we'll go into work session on 3492. Invite Mr. Gardner up. I see Jim Gardner here, too, or at least I did. Mr. Jim Gardner, no relation. Did you want to be up here? All right, thank you. We have the dash 5 amendments in front of us. And am I right on that, 3492?
Yes.
And Mr. Gardner, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members...
For the record, please introduce yourself.
That's what I was going to do. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General. And I'm here today to present to you the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3492. These amendments deal with a subject called gray marketing. And let me just take a moment to explain what gray marketing is. The major cigarette manufacturers in this country make cigarettes for domestic consumption, and they also make cigarettes for international or export. And there are differences between the cigarettes that are made in each of those different markets. There's a different formulation or blend for the export cigarettes. There's also a big price differential between those cigarettes in that a carton of Marlboros will sell for about $18 domestically, but will sell for about $9 a carton in the international or export market. The gray marketing procedure happens as follows. There'll be cigarettes made for export only. They'll be marked as export only. They will not have the Surgeon General's warnings. They'll then be exported out of the country to the Bahamas, at which point
the person who receives them will re-import them back into the country. They'll come to a port and then be distributed back throughout the United States, and on each step along the way will be sold for a little bit more money, but ultimately will be sold to a retailer for less money than the domestic cigarettes are sold for. Now, there are two problems with this. The first problem is the fact that there's a problem in the sense that the consumer is not getting what they think they're getting, because there's a difference between the two cigarettes, the export cigarettes and the domestic cigarettes. Secondly, there's a problem as far as the state of Oregon is concerned, because under the Master Settlement Agreement and the tobacco litigation, there's what's known as the volume adjustment. And the way that works is that there's a complicated formula that's based upon domestic cigarette sales. And since these are not domestic cigarette sales, but they are replacing cigarettes that would be sold in the domestic market, they will tend to make the payments that come to the state of Oregon less than they should be. And for that reason, the state of Oregon should be very interested in trying to stop the process. The Dash 5 amendments are our effort or attempt to basically do that. There was a work group put together that included the retailers, the Department of Revenue, representatives from the major cigarette manufacturers, and the Department of Justice. And we basically came up with this particular set of amendments to present to you. When we submitted the proposal to LC, there were a couple of things that didn't get taken care of quite right in terms of the notice that should be going to the retailers and the timing in terms of the state's ability to go in and be able to confiscate cigarettes after the effective date of this bill should it become law. And all the parties have agreed that we will work those things out with LC and present some additional amendments to take care and make sure that we have the bargain that we agreed upon on the Senate side. Let me just take you very briefly, in about 3 minutes, through the Dash 5 amendments.
Let me ask first if the members feel that they need to be taken through the Dash 5 amendments.
I don't think so. I definitely have some, because there may be another issue you may want to address. When I was in high school in San Antonio, with a lot of military bases, I worked at one of them, and I know that the BXs and the PXs, you could buy stuff at really reduced prices, and cigarettes were one of them, from what I remember. I'm wondering, since we do have one facility here in the state at least, if there's a concern about cigarettes coming from a military base back into the general population for resale, or if that's something that we should be looking at.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, I don't think that that's a problem, because I think those cigarettes would be domestic cigarettes, and perhaps there's a special price break for the U.S. government based upon the amount that they would buy. That's just my assumption. I don't know that for a fact. But as long as they were domestic cigarettes, and as long as they showed on the books of the cigarette companies as domestic cigarettes, I don't think we're concerned about, or should be concerned about, the price at which they're sold to consumers in the state.
Regarding your concern that you brought up, the second part about the state with this allotment, I'm just not sure if that is accounted for those cigarettes that are served on a federal at a federal institution.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sansky, I will look into that, and if that's something we need to address, we will try to address it on the Senate side.
Mr. Gardner, my question for you would be, if you're on the verge of some technical adjustments to this that you think would come out in the next 2 or 3 days, is that the situation, or do you think it's going to take a little longer?
Mr. Chairman, we would like to get the bill moving and get it going down the process here, and I know the stress that LC is under. I have personally suffered under that on several bills, and I think the best way to do this is to get the bill moving, and then when things kind of calm down a little bit at LC, we'll be able to work with them more effectively to get the bill in the proper form.
And your point here would be that the thrust of the policy issues are here in the Dash 5 amendments, and it's mainly some technical cleanup that will come later.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. Just very, very small, probably 2 sentences worth of amendments.
And we should be aware that the Dash 5 amendments are a gut and stuff on the bill. We did have Representative Lundquist come in yesterday and suggest some alternatives on his original bill. I discerned that those alternatives were not too attractive to the members of this committee, so I discerned that they would prefer the gut-and-stuff approach rather than the add-on approach, just to sort of cover that point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simmons and then Representative Fazansky. Representative Simmons.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence in bringing this forward. As you know, we've been working very hard on the on House Bill 2007, which is the Health Security Fund, and this goes a long way to help us with implementing the terms of the settlement, and when we're ready to move this out, I'd be happy to carry it on the floor.
All right, very well. I see that Bill Linden and Mark Nelson are also here. Representative Pozanski pointed it out to me, which I appreciate. Did you gentlemen want to make any remarks on this at this time? Comes Mark Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson representing R.J. Reynolds. We are in agreement with the Dash 5 and have worked with the Attorney General's office and retail groups, and I should also indicate that I represent 7-Eleven Southland Corporation as well. We had mentioned to Mr. Gardner if there was any way that we could conceptually adopt those amendments and move forward, we would prefer that as, instead of having to come back for concurrence from the Senate. It's a fairly simple amendment, but that's really up to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let me interrupt you and say what Mr. Gardner may not know is that we have had permission from the Speaker to carry on for the next few days as to bills that have been set for yesterday and today because of the backup of work that needs to be done. And it is possible for us to adopt these Dash 5 and then to have, if you wish, conceptual amendments presented to us even in the next hour, or better yet, we could set this for Tuesday for final action and adopt some supplemental amendments on Tuesday. Representative Fazansky?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that Representative Lundquist has brought to us is trying to close some gaps in some areas. I've looked at this and I actually had some amendments being drafted, and I don't know if they've come back to my office, which would just insert into the existing language where it's already prohibited, where there would be an attempt to buy. And I don't know if this is something the committee would want to consider or not. That was just trying to do a fix compared to what he was attempting to do.
I appreciate that. I'm discerning that we were running into so many other troubles on those issues, it might be best to overlook that.
That's fine.
Well, why don't we do this? Let's adopt the Dash 5, and we'll send the bill out. I have a feeling that once you see the bill in the next couple of weeks pass and it's on its way to the Senate, you may discern some other adjustments that are necessary, and that'll give the time for the dust to settle on this fairly new concept. And we'll be quick to respond to any Senate amendments over on the House side. So I thank you both for coming forward. Representative Simmons, do you move the Dash 5 amendments?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, we have a motion to adopt the Dash 5 amendments. To further discussion, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 5 amendments are adopted. Representative Simmons on the bill as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do move the bill to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard that motion. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3492 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Simmons will be the carrier. This closes the work session on House Bill 3492. Next up, House Bill 2744. Where are we on that, Council?
Mr. Chairman, the committee does have before Dash 1 amendments, and I believe Karen Brusseau is here. I'm informed that one of the proponents of the bill who could not be here today was not completely comfortable with the Dash 1 amendments, but they're generally in correct form, and this is before the committee for its consideration.
Let's take a look at it. I'm pulling up my copies of the amendments. I have. Is it the Dash 1?
Yeah, there it is.
Karen Brazell, would you come up, please? And does this also involve the state court administrators? No, not on this one. All right. We have these Dash 1 amendments. Let me first take us into work session on House Bill 2744. Ms. Brazell, what is your reaction to these Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Karen Brazell, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Youth Authority. The Dash 1 amendments meet the needs of the Oregon Youth Authority with regard to the Juvenile Justice Information System.
I guess one of the persons who had asked me to file this bill, Mr. Steve Dole, was wondering whether or not there needed to be any other language in here to, if I may call it, a hammer to hold state funds if the counties didn't cooperate. It seemed to me that we should always assume that the counties will cooperate with any state statute. Is that a fair assumption?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the counties have been very cooperative, and I'd be happy to come back in the next session, if that turns out to not be the case, to look for a hammer.
I'd say for the record, then, it's my expectation, too, that we can, we can routinely expect the counties to work with us and that we don't need to add a hammer if we have a requirement in the statute. We can always decide later, and when dispersing funds, if we need to encourage more cooperation. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would concur in terms of the hammer. As I understand it, there's some technical problems in terms of the coordination through Multnomah County system, and Multnomah County invested a great deal of money probably 2 years ago in establishing a program because we were concerned about some Y2K compliance, and as I understand it, we moved a little bit ahead of the state system, and there may be some formatting problems. Is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, actually, the Multnomah County was planning to use JGIS until approximately a year ago and determined at that time that they would build their own front-end data entry system. They are building that system in conformance with all of the requirements of JGIS and have very much agreed to the requirements in this bill, and Joanne Fuller from Multnomah County was here the last time I testified, and essentially the same amendments. You are correct that we haven't figured out exactly technically how they will transfer that information to us, but we're confident that we will be able to do that.
And do I understand correctly that Multnomah County is not objecting to the approach being taken here?
Mr. Chair, they are very supportive of this approach.
Okay. Nancy Miller, did you want to come forward and comment? The representative from Queens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Nancy Miller for the State Court Administrator's Office. I just wanted to make it clear for the record that the Judicial Department is working in cooperation with the Youth Authority on the development of JGIS. JGIS is not going to supplant our need for juvenile OJ and the Oregon Judicial Information Network, and what we're trying to do is build links between those two systems to try to avoid the duplicative collection of data and reporting of data. So one of our folks from our Information Systems Division is on board with the Youth Authority on the steering committee, but we will still need juvenile OJ in the judicial branch.
And you're supportive of this bill with the amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sincero.
Just a question. Could either of you comment on line 8 of the dash 1's confidentiality of information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sinceri, yes, this system is being developed as a shared database, and that means that there will have to be rules about governing which level of staff have access to which kinds of records. It is essentially, those rules will be no different than now govern paper records. It's just the way that the information is accessed will have to be different. Does that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just felt my blood pressure increase a little as I was reading down this, because I know you're talking about information here, and I know that I've experienced this and several others who are members of this body, that as we try to work with agencies, particularly with youth, where parents have called and have serious questions, and we try to investigate to some degree, and what we're told by state workers is, sorry, we're not talking to you about this because confidentiality is, and as I just saw this, it raises a concern to me that we're limiting some people from doing their job based on a comment like that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sinceri, the intent of putting that in the rule or in the statute here is to in no way limit existing confidentiality laws. In fact, the Oregon Youth Authority worked with the Newspaper Association during the last session to pass a bill that broadened the public information for juvenile offenders. Part of what you and your constituents may be running into is traditionally youth offenders have been governed largely by the same confidentiality laws that govern dependent children. That's the history the workers have been under. Many of them are simply unaware, and that's, we need to do a better job of educating them that the confidentiality laws have changed. They are much more open than they used to be. This session, I believe, this body will pass additional laws that further open up those.
Well, let's get to the point here, though. The point here is that you're simply saying that whatever the confidentiality substantive standards are set by the state, that's in another statute. You're simply going to have to make sure that those standards are addressed in this data network.
That's exactly the case.
So this is not an affirmation of any particular confidentiality system. It's simply a reflection that it's there.
That's right.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, does anyone care to move the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask one question
before Karen leaves.
Thank you. Can you tell me when we expect the systems to be fully integrated?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, fully integrated is an interesting term. I can tell you the timeline that we have planned is we are right now in the process of bringing counties, implementing the first modules of JGIS with counties. By the end of this calendar year, all the counties and the state will be using the first modules of JGIS and will be linked electronically with each other so that a youth who commits a crime in Clackamas County, that their workers will be able to go on the system and see if that youth is from Marion County. In the coming biennium, what we are working on are the interfaces that Ms. Miller suggested that we need to do with the state police and with the court system and others so that we can share those pieces of information that make sense to share with other agencies. So the integration is sort of a long-term notion, but counties and the state will be integrated by the end of the calendar year.
By way of example, and this is simply from reading news accounts, Kip Kinkle apparently had some involvement with the juvenile justice system in Deschutes County. He then moved to Lane County, and this is just based on what I read in the papers. The Lane County folks, when they were checking out Kip Kinkle, did not have a computer connection or any information about what happened in Deschutes County. Whether or not that would have made any difference, I don't know. But it would be good to have known, and they could calculate that in their decision about how to address the situation.
Mr. Chair, I asked a question because that I know that depending upon what government you're in, the computer systems don't even talk to each other inside the government in this entity, much less to an agency that's outside of the physical building. And so I guess my question is, are we fooling ourselves that we're going to have a system? I mean, is this false security that we're going to have a system that we're going to be able to put in somebody's name and be able to have that kind of instant communication throughout the system?
It's a legitimate question, and in fact, there is a monster project going on right now trying to reduce the amount of kidding of ourselves that goes on. This will simply move us towards saying to the counties and the state, we need that integrated system for this element, but the technical folks are still going to carry on with that monster project.
Representative Bowman, if I could add to that, my fear is that this has been touted as a silver bullet that will solve all the world's problems. That is not the case. It will, however, allow every county juvenile department and the state to share information on juvenile offenders. There are a lot of other interested parties, and it'll take us a while to get those linkages made. Thank you.
Representative Simmons?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I've been a part of many of the discussions about the information technology within the state and how they do not interact as part of the Information Management and Technology Committee in the interim and then as the Information Resources Management Council now that involves a lot of state agencies. And that is the goal, to integrate it so that there is a lot of crosstalk between agencies and information exchange between systems, so it's all homogeneous over time. But it is a battle, but this is a good step.
Thank you very much. Representative Sinceri, do you move the Dash 1 amendments?
Sure.
Representative Sinceri moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2744. Further discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash One amendments are adopted. Representative Simmons, do you move sending House Bill 2744 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Chair, I do.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Further discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. House Bill 2744 sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Simmons will be the carrier. This closes the work session on House Bill 2744. Next up is House Bill 3586.
No, we already did that.
Oh, we already did that. Sorry. 3395. We'll move into work session on House Bill 3395 and ask counsel to bring us up to date.
Mr. Chairman, we heard this bill a couple of days ago, and at that time, the committee members had some discussion, and we simply decided to reset the bill for today to determine what the committee wanted to do. I will mention that two of their proponents, Joel Shapiro and Dale Penn, are here, and I know that they would be willing to propose a couple of possible amendments to the committee if the committee would feel comfortable with that.
Thank you, counsel. Colleagues, I wanted to check first to see what the sense of the membership is, if someone wanted to move this bill or not, if you wanted information, so I'm just open to whatever. Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, based on his current form, I'm not comfortable with it. I know that individual that I put a lot of respect for, Larry Kilpatrick, who is a professor at the University of Oregon Law School, is probably one of the premier individuals, treatises, writers on evidence, had some concerns, at least with the first section. And I did see a memo from him that was sent to Professor Ballou, and I'm not comfortable with where it is now. I've spoken with Mr. Penn as well as Mr. Shapiro yesterday. I know both of them were inquiring about maybe making some other changes, so possibly I will change my position based on that, but I'd like us to at least hear what those other options might be and an opportunity, since we do have at least a day or two next week, to digest it. As I said, this is a really significant shift. It's a good cause, but beyond what's confined in House Bill 3395, I believe it can have a ramifications throughout the system for years to come.
All right. Representative Bowman?
Mr. Chair, I spent some time also yesterday talking to Senator Brown, who called and wanted me really to support this bill, and spent some time talking to Mr. Penn. And it is my understanding that there is a draft taking place that would limit the circumstances only to domestic violence cases. And I am in support, provided that it only deals with domestic violence cases. And so my understanding is that amendment is being drafted.
Is that Mr. Penn or Mr. Shapiro? Can you please both come forward for a moment? Let's get a quick update here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. We have provided some language to Mr. Horton which would accomplish the narrowing that Representative Bowman discussed. We would need the committee to refer that to LC to draft.
Right.
It's a very small amendment, but a very significant one.
It's also an accord, I would think, moving more in the direction of Professor Kilpatrick, if it's limited to domestic violence. When I saw his memo, I noted that he talked about domestic violence as the one area that he was open to. Well, what I'll do is I'll set this over so that there's an opportunity for that to be requested and for Representative Brzezinski to have a chance to evaluate that. Also, Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I think the other thing is that he had some real concerns about the prior inconsistent statements portion of that, and stated that, you know, as a traditionalist, that he felt that he would be willing to look at these modifications for a specific area. I think some of the things that I would also want to consider is just the time frame that we have, how it's going to be applied. 24 hours may not seem like a long time, but I think that 24 hours under these circumstances could be maybe too much time to allow someone to basically not report immediately and then to report, because in these type of cases, unfortunately, because of the emotions that are going on, sometimes I know that in our office we have had to seriously consider the positions and statements that have been made by an individual wanting to file charges because there are inconsistencies, and it is a shift to the point of where statements where a witness could not be required to be there to be confronted by their the person being accused.
All right,
Chair.
I
just would say that where I was uncomfortable with this, if we narrow this to domestic violence, I would be more comfortable with it.
All right, well, you've heard the comments. You'll be well advised about that. We'll set this for Tuesday. I'm not inclined to keep setting it over beyond Tuesday unless Legislative Council is unable to produce the drafts in time. I promised the Speaker I'd keep after this agenda. She's giving us some time here, and I certainly want us to do it right, but I also want us to understand that we are under time pressure, appropriate time pressure. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will carry over House Bill 3395, and this concludes the work session on that bill. Okay, we're going to skip over 2096. 2488, I understand we're still seeing some work being done. Do we have a final set of amendments here yet?
Mr. Chairman, I have not received them. But those would be the dash twos. Has anybody received any from the committee?
I got them.
Dash two, I have dash two.
Or, I'm sorry, is it dash three then?
Anybody here from corrections?
What is it then?
20th. It's got to be threes.
It must be the threes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We will carry over House Bill 2488 to, was it Tuesday? Or is that set for Monday?
Tuesday, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So House Bill 2488 is carried over. We're going to skip over 2562. We have 3044 here. So let's see where we're in that one. Well, let's move us into work session on 3044. Mr. DeLashmit is here. I'd invite you up. Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian DeLashmit, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Please join me, Brad. What you see in front of you with the Dash 1 Amendment is at your direction to work with some interested parties, particularly the State Court Administrator's Office and the Health Division. What you have in front of you are really four different changes to the bill. The first two deal with questions or concerns that the Health Division had, and I believe fully addressed their concerns, and we're in full agreement. That is on line 12. And throughout the bill that it specifically states hepatitis B and C rather than just hepatitis proper. That's purely technical. The other change that the Health Division was interested in is on line 15. They wanted to actually see that before this application or request came forward to the court that it required a healthcare provider make a determination as to whether or not there was a substantial exposure. Our concern was, in some cases, in some parts of the state, there may not be a healthcare provider immediately available to make that assessment, and we didn't want to hold the process up. So the compromise was the language you see before you on that. The remaining two issues were issues that Mr. Swank brought to myself and Representative and the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and we attempted to respond. The question was on page 2, line 16, to expedite the process. We were looking at the day of or the very next day to hold the ex parte hearing. Mr. Swank pointed out that in some cases that's not possible and suggested a reasonable time period. And our response to reasonable was reasonable, but in no cases longer than 3 days because of the issue that we're dealing with. And he can address whether he thinks that's reasonable or not, but that was our response to his concern. And then one of the other questions they brought is line 18, second page, probable cause to conclude that. The point that he brings up is a very valid point, is at what level of proof are we asking the court to rule upon in order to compel the drawing of blood? And on the advice of our attorney, we asked to insert probable cause in there. With that, those are the amendments from our perspective.
Thank you, Mr. DeLashmit. Mr. Swank, good morning.
Jim Mannix, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. We appreciate Mr. DeLashmit's working with us on some of the issues on this. I'm going to raise, there are some issues that we talked about that were not resolved, which you may or may not see as a problem. And there's sort of a general philosophical thing I want to raise in relation to this bill. And I'm not doing it to throw cold water on the bill. I just think it's something you should be aware of. This bill creates a probable cause type proceeding with the amendments. It's very similar to a search warrant that police seek on a search. And it creates a situation where the state is going to order a search of a person's body. And there are constitutional provisions that relate to searching a person's body. Now, I can't say that this procedure goes across the constitutional lines. I just thought you should be aware that this is like a search warrant proceeding. It's put in the middle of a series of statutes that create a civil procedure to do the same thing for a certain limited group of people that has a higher standard of proof. This will establish a lower standard of proof that may or may not pass, but it's an issue and it may subject it to challenge. I'm not going to say that it will die on challenge, but we appreciate the fact that at least the standard that was put in there is probable cause. So you've got a private person that's asking for a search warrant for the blood of another person, and it's an interesting situation and somewhat new in Oregon law. So I just thought you should be aware of that as you go on. We have a couple of technical concerns remaining about this. This is a broader net than the civil procedure that it's put in the center of. And, for instance, it can be used against people who may be in custody or may not be in custody. And the two concerns that we have, particularly, in addition to the broader general thing that I just mentioned, is if you go to page 2, of the bill, on lines 26, I'm sorry, on line 19, it says, if the court finds that the person has been exposed, the court shall order the testing of the source person. And the two concerns that we've got is if you've got a person in custody, it doesn't say the court is going to order to test the person.
Shouldn't the court exercise a little common sense at that point, Mr. Swank?
Well, maybe they should. I'm concerned that you've got a local government or somebody who's getting an order, and the other problem is who serves the order, because in the civil proceeding, you would serve it as you would any civil papers in a suit because you've got parties. Here you've got people who weren't parties to the proceeding. And the question is, are they going to get this order from a sheriff, or is it going to be served as a motion in a civil suit to which they weren't a party, or how is that going to be served? And that's my concern, because it's more like a search warrant than a civil suit. You have parties who weren't there, and all of a sudden, I mean, a civil suit you could mail them an order and say you've got to serve an
Mr. Swank, maybe I'm misunderstanding something. Are the results of these tests going to be made available to the prosecution?
Not that I know of.
Then why do you keep saying it's similar to a search warrant? Because a search warrant means we're gathering evidence to be used against somebody in a criminal case. And here we're saying we've got someone who's potentially been subjected to exposure to hepatitis or HIV,
mm-hmm.
and they're asking to find out quickly if they've been exposed.
Okay.
So they can initiate treatment, and we're saying in the statute the results are confidential except for the person who's been exposed. We're not saying the prosecution can use this evidence. In fact, they don't have access to it, do they?
Chair Mannix, the reason I say that it's similar to a search warrant is because you have an ex parte proceeding where the other party is not allowed to participate.
Well, then it's similar to a temporary restraining order, too. I mean, we don't have to talk about the criminal connotation, do we?
Well, Chair Mannix, except what you're doing is you're ordering a search of the person's body. And like I say, it's sort of launching into a new area.
Well, and we're also making a record right now, and I'm not challenging you personally, Mr. Swank, but I think it's important that anyone who hears this tape or reads a transcript of this hearing understand that we are aware that there's a difference between going after evidence to be used in a criminal prosecution.
Yes.
And although you may use a certain methodology, gaining some
some information to make available to somebody confidentially so they'll know whether or not they have to start undergoing treatment.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chad.
We'll let you talk a couple more minutes and then we'll...
Okay. I believe that the constitutional provisions that apply to the state ordering a search apply in both civil and criminal circumstances. The search and seizure provisions are applicable in any circumstances. That's why, and I was around...
This isn't the state seeking the evidence. This is an individual seeking the evidence.
Chair Mannix, that's correct. But it is the state ordering the search of a person based on the application in an ex parte proceeding. And I'm raising the issue. I can't tell you how it will be resolved, but I think that the search and seizure provisions of the Oregon Constitution and of the...
We appreciate that, Mr. Smith. My question for you would be, and then Representative Bowman will have a question. Do you have any better idea what we can do to help people?
I don't. And I'm raising so you know, as I say, so you know that it's an issue and that it may be around there and it may subject us. I know that when they crafted the last HIV series, they were very careful to keep it in the civil context to give the other party notice, to give them an opportunity to appear, and it was for those reasons. And I'm not saying that this will necessarily cause this to be thrown out. All I'm trying to do is to make you aware of the issue that's here.
Thank you.
On the second issue, the issue about who serves the notice, it arises, it becomes important because you don't have parties to the suit, because it's an ex parte proceeding.
So do you have a suggestion for a...
I assume that if it's going to be an order of the court, you would want it served by the sheriff in this instance. Upon the...
Isn't there a generic statute that would call for the sheriff to serve orders of the court upon the order? The judge would just say who's going to serve?
Not necessarily. No, there isn't. That's why I'm raising the issue. I mean, in a search warrant...
I'm just being a little tested because this has been pending. And if you need to have some language that accomplishes that goal, and if Mr. DeLashman doesn't have a problem with that, I would be happy to have you present that language.
Well, and I just saw, we talked last week. I presented these issues to Mr. DeLashman, and I saw the amendments to the first time this morning when I showed up, so I didn't know whether they had been addressed or not.
No, that's fair enough. That's a fair response.
And the issue about serving the order... and the issue about if they're in custody, does the local jurisdiction that holds them in custody have to respond? Are the only two remaining ones that we have in relation to this, other than to make you aware of the broader issue about the search? And that's just something for you to consider. I am not saying that that will cause it to go one way or another. I think it's an issue that's lurking out there that you should be aware of.
Thank you. Representative Bowman, I apologize for keeping you waiting.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have a couple of questions, actually. Upon reviewing this bill, the law enforcement components, I understand. Law enforcement personnel don't normally come in contact with bodily fluid unless there's a violent situation taking place. So that one, I understand.
Maybe or maybe not.
Maybe or maybe not. I mean, but it's not... It's not a day-to-day occurrence, unlike emergency medical technicians and paramedics who, as a regular part of their job, they come in contact with people's bodily fluids. And so...
If I may...
You may.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, it's not unusual for a police officer to be the first person responding to a traffic accident and, in fact, be exposed to the same blood that an EMT would be. It's not unusual for them in confrontational situations to have that same type of exposure. So I didn't want it to lead anybody to the belief that it's EMTs for the non-confrontational and public safety or police for the confrontational situations.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification, but if I could continue with my train of thought. People that are paramedics and again, emergency medical technicians have an expectation that they're going to come in contact with bodily fluids on a very regular basis because it's part of what they do. And so my question becomes, probable cause says that you've come in contact with bodily fluids. So are we going to be requiring anybody who, emergency medical technicians and paramedics come in contact with in the course of doing their regular job, to be automatically tested for HIV because probable cause would be blood or any other bodily fluid. And, you know, so therefore you have a potential for exposure. And I want to see where the line is and who makes the decision about what's part of the day-to-day job as compared to something that compels you to believe that you've come in contact with a substance that may in cause have one of these diseases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think there's actually two filters in this bill, and I'm, after reflecting on the suggestion that the Health Division gave us and incorporating in there, I think that's the first filter. The first filter, obviously, is a health care provider. It is common practice that what will happen is, whether it's an EMT or a firefighter or a police officer or a correction officer, that when they believe they've been exposed, and accidentally or intentionally, that they'll immediately go to a healthcare provider. Healthcare provider will evaluate that exposure, and it may be that upon reviewing the facts with the worker, the healthcare provider, the doctor, nurse practitioner, whatever, may say, "We don't think you have a problem. You didn't have any open cuts. You were wearing protected gloves. Therefore, we don't think you had any exposure. We suggest you not go forward with not only this proceeding, but we don't think you need to go on the preventative measures, the interferon and other preventative measures that would help you if, in fact, you were exposed." So that's the first filter. And then, of course, the second filter is the information that's given to the judge. And the judge then, based upon the information that's presented to them, would make a ruling or a judgment as to whether or not they believe there was substantial exposure. So we think there's two filters in here that are set in place to really deal with your particular situation.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We will set this bill for Tuesday. I would ask Mr. Swink, if you need permission from us, we'll get it for you, to request LC amendments as to those technical concerns so that we can address them, and it will be up for final action on Tuesday. And I discern that the bill has legs, so we just need to make sure we finalize this. This concludes the work session on House Bill 3044. We've done 3378. Oh, okay, HJM 10. We had pending. We'll go into work session on HJM 10. Do you still have your people outside? I'm sorry,
okay.
Didn't watch the clock. I wasn't thinking about it. We are back into work session HJM 10 because we had pending a notice of reconsideration from Representative Simmons. The question at this point is whether or not there is going to be a motion presented to us for reconsideration.
Excuse me. That was on
HJM
10.
By here. Okay.
I would make a motion that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Memorial 10.
All right. Representative Simmons moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed HJM 10 out to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, the process that works here is this. The first motion up is whether we will reconsider. We can decide to reconsider or not. If we decide not to reconsider, it's over. If we decide to reconsider, we then have a vote again on whether to send it to the floor with a due pass. And then we just have that, and we're re-voting on the motion. Now, I will indicate to my colleagues that out of deference to Representative Simmons, I will vote in favor of reconsidering. However, I have not changed my position on the original bill. So, the motion is whether we will reconsider the action that we took yesterday, and I will ask that the clerk call the roll on that motion.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianella?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
No.
Chair Manning?
Aye. And here's Representative Sinceri just in the nick of time. Representative Sinceri, and I apologize, Representative, I didn't think about that dynamic, but I wanted to give you your shot at this. Representative Sinceri, Representative Simmons has moved to reconsider the vote from yesterday as to passage out of HJM 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. How do you vote on Representative Simmons' motion to reconsider?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri votes aye. The motion is
Mr. Chair,
carried.
Point of order.
Yes.
I think I did that before you hit the
Sure.
Is this a simple majority of the committee, or does it take a two-thirds to reconsider?
It takes a majority to reconsider.
Okay.
However, we now have the issue in front of us. The pending issue was the motion yesterday to send HJM 10 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Chair.
Representative Simmons.
I would move that we table HJM 10 until Monday, allow me an opportunity to visit with Representative Sinceri and Representative Gianella for a few moments for further work.
Mr. Chair, I would object to that.
I think a motion to table is not debatable. I would, however, be able to ask you, what is the intent of the motion to table?
The intent is for discussion of a minority report, whether to proceed down that road.
You may give notice of a minority report without having to table a motion. All right, the motion is to table. It's not debatable. We will call the roll on the motion to table.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sunseri?
Aye.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
No.
Chair Manning?
No. The motion to table is defeated. We have in front of us again the action taken yesterday. Is there further debate on the action taken yesterday? Seeing no further debate, you will please call the roll on the motion from yesterday to send HJM 10 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Representative Gianella?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Simmons?
No.
Representative
No.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
Yes.
Aye. The motion is carried, and HJM 10, as amended, is still sent to the floor with the due pass. Is there notice of a minority report?
I believe we have till 5 o'clock.
All right. That's pending. There is no notice at this point. This closes the work session on HJM 10.
I will volunteer myself.
President Bowman is still the secretary.
Sacrifice yourself.
On the table of liberty. We will move on to HB 2397. Where are you on that one? Oh, yes.
2397.
Okay. I need to look at it. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, members of the committee, 2397 has the dash one amendments, and it is a gut and stuff.
Oh, okay. I remember this one.
Okay.
Colleagues, let me tell you about 20. This is a gut and stuff. If you read the Margie Belay column in the Oregonian about the retroactive impact of the revocation or the pulling back of driver's licenses, what this does, this says that if someone had already been reinstated by DMV and then based on the passage of legislation, their licenses were taken away from them, that they may go back to DMV and ask DMV, the administrator, to still grant them a license if the administrator determines that public safety will be served. It is, in effect, a clemency clause for people. There's 900-odd people who had their licenses taken away, even though they'd already, in effect, served their sentence. And the distinction was that a license is a privilege as opposed to a right. Therefore, the retroactivity was not a problem. That is now going into litigation. I've told Mr. Dole that I don't agree with retroactively changing sanctions, whether or not it's a privilege or a right, and that people who had been following the law, in my view, should be given the opportunity to keep following the law, that they'd served their time and they'd gotten their licenses back. There is a fix that's supposedly coming over from the Senate, but this being near the end of our term to send over House bills, I put together this fix on that issue. Now, I see that the Dash 1 amendments that are in front of us do some other things, too. Yes. 2397. And Mr. Horton has slipped out of the room, but I've... The clemency provisions I was proposing were fairly straightforward. This includes a lot of fixes that are being proposed over in the Senate, probably in Senate Bill 1207.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I my understanding of what this bill was to do was to take Senate Bill 1207, incorporate the Dash 1 amendments to that bill, and present it as this bill.
All right. Now, what happens is this. Senate Bill 1207 has this complicated system for surgically establishing situations where the licenses can be reinstated. We have in front of us a Dash 1 amendment that does that, but it also says, well, we'll have this clemency program where you can ask for the director, and that's at the end of these amendments, pages 26 and 27, that you can apply to the director for what I'll call clemency. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm going to, when we get there, I know we're in work session, so I'm going to be moving the dash ones. And I just want to put on the record the reason I think this is important. I believe I did support the original bill, not realizing at the time how many people were going to be impacted. And as the chair said, somewhere my numbers were 600, he says 900 people that were basically lost their license. And some of the cases that came forward, we had people that had served their time, had become, quote-unquote, productive citizens, were raising families, were in need of vehicle to actually drive to and from to work, or their job was actually driving, and they were basically out on the street without a job because of the long arm of the law going back in time and grabbing them up. So it seems to me that what we're going to do is we're going to allow those individuals to at least be able to present their case back to the Department of Transportation for consideration of having their license reactivated. It's not a what I would call a clean sweep of each and every one's going to get it back. They still have to go through some procedure to demonstrate that they should get back. So there seems to be the check and balance, but at least the opportunity for people to regain something that's been maybe just ceremoniously taken away without forethought.
And may I suggest, Representative Brzezinski, that I appreciate your comments and I agree with them. I would suggest that since the first part of this is in the Senate bill and is terribly complicated, what we can do is offer our clemency program, which is only the last part of this, if there's unanimous consent to agree to a conceptual amendment, which is to just proceed with Section 11 and Section 12, which is the clemency program, because I'm advised that the rest of this has got conflicts with other bills and everything
right.
else, and this would be a clean clemency program. Is there any objection to suspension of the rules for purposes of allowing a conceptual amendment to rely only on Sections 11 and 12? Of the Dash 1 amendments. Seeing no objection, the rules are suspended. Representative Brzezinski, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 1s as they've been amended by this committee to include only Sections 11 and Section 12 of the Dash 1s, which are on page 26, starting on line 26, and concluding on page 27 through what looks like line 15 and a half, end of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Simmons.
Is that Senate bill, is it moving along?
I do not know. Yes, I guess I'm getting the indication it is. I should also mention that Section 11 and 12 are not inconsistent with the Senate bill. They would provide their own simple alternative. The Senate bill is pretty detailed and complex. This says, here's how you can go back and try to get your license reinstated.
Appropriate. I'd hate to end the session without having finished work on this. I do have some constituents who've been caught, served their five-year suspension, gone, finished their schooling, youngsters at the time, gone to work now, and all of a sudden, 2 years later, are without a driver's license because this retroactive piece of legislation went into effect. And I think it's very, very important that we do complete this while we are here.
Very well. The motion by Representative Brzezinski is in front of us. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. Representative Brzezinski, do you have a further motion on the bill?
I do. I would make a motion that we send the bill as amended by this committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard that motion. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. And House Bill 2397, as amended, is sent to the floor with a due pass. The chair will volunteer himself as a carrier on this. Thank you, colleagues. This concludes the work session on House Bill 2397. Now, let's see. And by the way, we are going to adjourn by 10:45. I
so that members can get ready for session. Representative Bowman, do you need any time to get outside, or you? Let's take a quick look here. Did you ever get the rest of your amendments on 3057?
No.
And our next work day for that would be Tuesday?
Tuesday.
All right, we're going to set 3057 over to Tuesday. I do want to say I'm going to get that identity theft bill out, and whatever else we decide we want to add, that'll be up to us, because it has a relating to crime relating clause. So that will be set over to Tuesday. We have 2096 pending. I'm trying to move quickly here, Representative Bowman.
Where are we on this?
Check on that.
We were holding. Why were we holding on that? We just got dash twos. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, wasn't this one be two dash three? I can't remember.
I think we got dash twos 2 days ago.
I thought the chair was going to introduce an amendment to this bill that dealt with another issue that he wanted to address. But maybe that's the dash two amendment here.
Oh,
trying to pull my own copy.
Yeah, we don't have that back yet. Then.
We don't have it back.
Still don't have it.
All right, we will carry 2096 over to Tuesday. Now we'll have an interesting policy discussion because we have 2562. Let's take a look at that.
If you want to go ahead and pass,
would you please?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, the bill 2562 in its original form has to do with what is defined as major crimes in the bill, and it adds on additional periods of imprisonment for a person who is convicted of a major crime and then also has a previous conviction for a major crime. I would note for the committee that this does differ from a prior bill considered by the committee in that for a person convicted of a major crime for the first time, there is not the 14-month mandatory minimum sentence. What this bill does in its original form is provide that if a person has one prior major crime conviction and is convicted of another major crime, they serve an additional 12 months in prison. For two prior convictions of a major crime, that goes up to 2 years, and then for three or more prior convictions, that does go up to 3 years. The list of crimes that are defined as major crimes is on the front of the bill. The committee does have before it the dash one amendments, and these are, it's a change to the list, not a major change, but what the dash one amendments change is as follows. Instead of only arson in the first degree being a major crime, it would be any arson, which would be arson one and arson two. Instead of, on line 15, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle committed only in certain ways, it would be only any prior conviction for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. Instead of felon in possession of a firearm only in certain circumstances, it would be all felon in possession of firearm charges. On line 26, instead of escape one, it would include either escape one or two. And the dash one amendments would take out lines 27, 28, 29, and 30, which are the bribery crimes and the crime of perjury. Finally, what the dash one amendments would do is to, I believe they also eliminate line 31. Let me check on that. Yes, the criminal mischief provision.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess first, did I bring us into work session? If not, we're in work session on 2562.
Looking at the relating clause and hearing counsel speak, I'm wondering if this actually can be done in that relating clause. I'm just not sure. I mean, procedure is compared to sentencing.
Well, if I may, the actual original bill was also a sentencing bill.
Okay. Okay. I think it can. Yeah. All right. And I would assume that this has a Ways and Means referral?
Actually, this is a referral to the voters, so it would not be referred to Ways and Means.
And I should clarify that as with the amendments. The original bill was not a referral. The amendments would make it a referral.
And again, what was the difference between the dash one and the dash two?
Just going to ask that.
Dash two?
Yeah.
Dash two. Well, they're actually dated the same date, and I'm wondering if there's any difference at all.
Those are both dash ones, aren't they?
They're both dash ones. I have two of them in front of me, and the numbers are starting to
fuzz.
The dash ones are the same as the dash ones.
Okay. We have the dash one amendments. Well, colleagues, the
bill is in front of us. Representative Sinceri, do you move the dash one amendments?
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Representative Sinceri moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2562.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Will this, in fact, be part of this special election, or is this going to come at the next regular general election? Mr. Chair, I just read and answered my own question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The next general election.
Yeah.
This is a slimmed-down version of Measure 61.
How slim? Looks pretty
good. Oh, looks like you expanded.
Well, we gave it a few calories here, but we also put it on a weight program.
We just reshaped.
We reshaped it.
Turtles are good.
Further debate on the motion? All right, I think we'll have some objection on this, so I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative
Bowman?
No.
Representative Diabella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sunseri?
Yes.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
No.
Chair Mannix?
Aye. The motion carries. The dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Notice of a possible minority report.
Okay, well, we'll note that, so we still have to get to the main motion.
You know, we're big enough at this that we don't have to go through, we don't have to table it for a day to discuss it.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2562 as amended to the floor with the pass recommendation.
All right. Representative Sinceri moves that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and send the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. So moved. And Representative Hansen.
The cost, even as part of a general election, is there legislative fiscal?
No, because, well, it's added to the ballot, and any referral to the voters will have some additional expense on the ballot, but the ballot, the election cost is all being done. If there was not, there's a separate bill to establish, for instance, the special election in November. And that bill had to go to Ways and Means because they have to go through the expense of the special election.
But doesn't each individual question also raise the cost of the election?
No, the referrals to the voters, they certainly do, but it's generally being construed if you're just adding it to the general election ballot, you don't send it through Ways and Means. I should add that if you want to send it to Ways and Means, that's okay, but there cannot be any minority report if you send a bill to Ways and Means.
Never mind.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Since we're at the part of discussion and debating this, could the chair provide us with the rationale for the type of sentencing that's being requested to be imposed and what empirical data, if any, was used to determine what would be appropriate on these various offenses?
Basically, the same arguments I would have presented in regard to Measure 61 and the voter's pamphlet statement that I submitted on Measure 61.
Which are?
I'm not going to repeat it any further.
All right, Mr. Chair. We have another bill that we passed that went in effect, I guess, in 97, 34, 88, whichever one dealt with repeat property offenders. I guess, can you express, or would you express, why that has not been sufficient to, at least as we, I remember from the discussion here, to run its course to see exactly what impact it has before layering another system on top of the existing systems?
My opinion that it doesn't get enough bad guys for long enough.
That should be a good enough record.
Just a further discussion on the motion.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call the roll on the motion to refer to the floor with the due pass and rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Attorney lingo.
Yeah, right. They understand each other.
No, it's a single motion that we rescind our referral to Ways and Means and send to the floor with the due pass, as amended.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sunseri?
Yes.
Vice Chair Brzezinski?
No.
Chair Mannix?
Aye. The motion is carried, and there has been notice of the possible minority report, so we will hold
Chair,
over.
Mr.
Yes, that's correct. But the first one was actually a notice of minority, possible minority report on the dash one amendments.
Right.
We were going to try to amend the dash one, but we'll just stick with the bill now.
All right, we do have notice of a possible minority report. This concludes the work session on, well, I'll assign myself as a carrier, and this concludes the work session on House Bill 2562. I think we've run through the agenda, so we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.